Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Write on Four Corners. I'm your host, Del Cherie Gladden. I'm a writer and editor and journalist and author of over 30 published novels. And on this week, I have Paul Semendinger, and we're going to be talking about his book about Roy White. And I'm really excited because I love baseball. Paul, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. My name is Paul Semendinger. I do not have 30 novels, so I'm very jealous that you have so many, but I've written a number of books. This is my second book about the Yankees. I had a book previously called The Least Among Them, which talked about the 29 players whose entire baseball career lasted for just one game as a Yankee. I also have one published novel, Scattering the Ashes, a book of motivational passages called Impossible is an Illusion. But this is my most recent book. It's a collaboration I did with former Yankees great Roy White, who was a Yankee for 15 years and one of the great Yankees, really, but one of the most underrated Yankees of all time. And this is his autobiography that I wrote with him, and it's called From Compton to the Bronx.
I will say right off the bat, I've always been a Dodger fan, but I have nothing against the Yankees, unlike a lot of other Dodger fans.
Well, our publisher, Artemisia Publishing, you know, Jeff Habinger, who runs that company, he published my novel, Scattering the Ashes. And when I was querying it and we were talking, I mentioned that I have a Yankees blog, start spreading the news. And he said, I'm a Royals fan. So if you're a Yankees fan, I don't think we can work together. He was kidding, of course. But yeah, I get that a lot.
That's one that a lot of people either love or hate the Yankees. But this really was just so fascinating to read. I loved being able to get this glimpse of what the Yankees looked like in the 60s and 70s. It wasn't an era of baseball that I was super familiar with. And it just gives you such a different look because the Yankees were a very different team during that time period. It was kind of the end of some of the big names like Mickey Mantle. And in this seemed like really kind of transition period of bringing in new talent and building that up. And it was just a really different look than what you get with the Yankees more recently that have dominated so many years for so long at this point. It was like, oh, yeah, they did have a period where, you know, it was a little bit of a struggle to build that back up.
The Yankees were in the World Series in 1964, and then they didn't make it back until 1976. And unfortunately for Roy White and a few others who played in that era, like Bobby Mercer, Mel Stottlemyre, they played during an era, an unlikely era in Yankees history, but they played during an era when the Yankees were not successful. And so they went to the World Series in 1964. And by 1966, just 2 years later, they were in last place. And as you said, guys like Whitey Ford, Mickey Mantle, Elston Howard, Roger Maris, big-time Yankees, all-stars, some future Hall of Famers, they got old and they started to retire. And the Yankees were in this period of time that seemed to last for them, I'm sure, forever, where they just didn't win a whole lot.
And to see that from a player's perspective, who during that period, Roy White was a very good player and he was playing with some very good players. But I mean, right now the Yankees have been struggling a bit. So have the Dodgers. Everybody's hurt. But as a fan, especially you know, watch the stats and you hear the commentary and you watch the games, and it's just such a different experience than reading his account of those years. And one of the things that I found really interesting, especially in the first section of the book, him talking about just, it was just year after year, the same thing, and like how frustrating that got for the players. And just like, but we're good. We're just not getting there. We're not getting all
correct,
the way.
Correct. In 1970, Roy tells the story of the Yankees, the once mighty Yankees, finished in second place And they had, that was their best showing in many, many years. And they had a big champagne celebration after the season. And the New York beat writers, they got all over them because they said, what has happened to the mighty Yankees? And incidentally, you know, you can't take these things out of the context of when it happens. So the Mets become a team in 1962, and the Mets were terrible, right? They're one of the worst teams in the history of the world were the 1962 Mets. And throughout the 60s, the miracle Mets, they win the World Series, the amazing Mets. And here the Yankees World Series team, the great winners, they were never there. And then the year after the Mets win the World Series, the Yankees are celebrating second place. So it was like the world turned upside down.
Yeah, that was what I really enjoyed that section, because it just kind of shows like how sometimes media versus the people who are in it, you know, you take this view of like you get to judge because you're on the outside and, you know, you're taking this perspective of, oh, why are you celebrating second place? Like, that's not worth celebrating. It's like for a team that was really building themselves back up, and that was a big win for them, even if it wasn't the big win.
That's correct, because, you know, growth is something that takes place over time. And so, you know what? They had been terrible just a couple of years before that, the worst team in the league. So, you know, if you're in the pennant race till the end and you finish in second place, at least in those days when there was no wild card or anything like that, that was a victory of sorts. You know, some people say second place is the first loser, but when you hadn't been that high in the standings, it was a good place to get to. And it sort of signaled that maybe better days were coming.
Another thing that I thought was really so interesting is just baseball is a game of tradition, and changes are fought long and hard in a lot of cases. But it was interesting to see what baseball was like during that time period. And there have been a lot of changes. One of the aspects that I thought was really kind of eye-opening was when Roy was talking about their salaries and the first player strike. And you're like, you know, that he's getting these winter jobs to make his bills because none of them made enough to just be like, you know, we're set. We don't have to rely on that. You know, like they really were concerned when the players' strike started. How are we going to make it if this goes on for very long? And it was just such a different attitude based on how the league operated at that time than what you see today when there's a player strike. Like it's a different dynamic.
Yeah, no doubt. Back then, for most of Roy White's career, the players didn't make big money. At the end of his career, like in the mid-1970s, free agency finally comes, and some of the superstars started making millions of dollars, but Roy White never made millions of dollars, and most of the players didn't. And you're right, that strike, 1972, the players were really concerned because if they were on strike, they weren't going to get paid, and they needed the money. And they did. They worked in the wintertime. They had various jobs. They, you know, and they did things to make money, playing, you know, charity basketball games, or and maybe the players might be given $100 each to participate. And that $100 would help put food on the table for the winter when they weren't getting paid. So it was a much different time for the players. And Roy White, earlier in the book, talks about how lots of the kids in his neighborhood were signed to these big, giant contracts. But I believe his contract was only for $5,000 if he made it to the major leagues. I believe he got like $1,000 or $2,000 as a signing bonus. And then the other $3,000 would be paid only if he made it to the major leagues. And, you know, you hear numbers like that, even from the 1960s when he signed in 1962. Those aren't big, giant numbers that are going to wow you. That didn't come till much later.
Yeah, we just had the MLB draft, and I'm here in New Mexico. We, I think, had two players from colleges here that were drafted, and that was exciting news. It's a completely different experience today. It really kind of put a different perspective on the game today and how it's gotten from its early beginnings and what a lot of the players have gone through and worked for to bring the game to the point where it is today, where the players are looked at differently and treated differently. And I'm sure there's some debate back and forth on how far things have gone and all of that, and yes, and the money and the caps, and you know, it was just really interesting to see how those changes have occurred and who some of those players were, as he was talking about watching through a period of baseball where some of those big changes like free agency, realizing that had some options, and if they have some options, they have a little more power in determining their own future.
That is correct. With free agency and some of the gains the players made through that strike, they did get a little bit more control. And they, of course, they got more and more control over time, but where they would play. Roy White does tell the story of late in his career with the Yankees. He wasn't getting a whole lot of playing time. And there's a rule that if you've been in the league for 10 years and with a club for 5 years, you could veto a trade. And he was traded to the Oakland A's, who in the beginning of the decade of the 70s were great. But by the mid-1970s and into the late 1970s were terrible because their owner, Charles Finley, had basically sold off all their great players. And Roy White had the ability to veto that trade. He said, I'm not going to Oakland. That would be terrible. I don't want to go and be in the worst team in the league and in a stadium where nobody's going to come watch me play. And so that was a right he wouldn't have had early on in his career. No player would have had that in the 1960s or before.
Yeah. That really changes a lot of aspects of the game when players started having some power. Like, these are conversations that would not have been had.
If you were traded, you were traded, right? That was your choice. Mm-hmm. Go to the team. And when your contract came, you basically had a choice. Sign it or don't play. Players were bound to the team by the reserve clause. There was no negotiating.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you just kind of the process of putting this together. Because that just, I imagine, was fantastic.
So, yes, the whole thing was a dream come true in so many regards. I'm not a person who has a lot of contacts, or really any contacts, with Major League Baseball players. I've interacted with some through podcasts or anything, but never really on a level like this. So the story, it basically goes like this. I do a couple of podcasts on a network called the Northeast Streaming Sports Network. I have a couple of Yankees shows. And the person who runs it, Mac McGrath, had reached out to me. This is probably in October of 2021. And he said, I have a connection and we're going to get Roy White. We're going to be able to interview Roy White. Would you want to be part of that? I'm like, yes, Roy White. Are you kidding? One of the heroes of my childhood. He was a great Yankee when I first came to love the game. Yes, of course. And so we arranged it for like a Wednesday night or something like that. And at the last minute, because he's a busy man, Roy White had to cancel and rescheduled for a day when I wasn't available. There was, I was a elementary school principal. I worked 24 hours a day and there must have been a school event that night. And so I said, I can't do it. But I said to Mac, tell Roy White that I would love to write his autobiography with him. You know, I'm a person who believes in dreaming, make big dreams and shoot for the stars. And I did not expect, number one, Mac really to even ask Roy White. Number two, for Roy White to even consider it. But a couple days later or the next day, I got a text from Mac and it had Roy White's phone number. So I texted Roy White and he texted me back. This is now around Thanksgiving time and said, yeah, let me think about it. I'll get back to you. Again, he's a busy man. It takes about a month. It's now over Christmas time and principals work over holidays. And so I guess early that morning I said, you know, I have some free time. I'm not tied into the school day, the regular school day for these days. If you have time, I'd love to talk to you about the idea of writing a book. And Roy White has always been known as one of the classiest baseball players. And so many guys from his era, Billy Martin, Greg Nettles, Sparky Lyle, and a lot of the New York sports writers wanted Roy White to tell his story, but they wanted Roy White to tell all the secrets, you know. What kind of gossip can you share about Reggie Jackson and Thurman Munson and George Steinbrenner and Billy Martin? And Roy White was too classy to ever do that. So my pitch to Roy White was, I will write your story, but it will be your story, not my story. Every last word in the book will be yours. Like, you will have final approval over everything. I want this story to represent who you are and the stories you wish to tell. So anyway, that was my pitch to him. And then I reached out over Christmas time over that vacation and I was driving home from work. And my phone rang and it was Roy White. I can't believe it. Roy White just called me. And really, if that's where the story ended, that would have been a pretty neat thing for me to say. Like, yeah, Roy White once called me on the phone. But I gave him the pitch. He thought about it. And he texted me a day or two later and said, let's do it. And we started just like this on a Google Meet. And the technology didn't necessarily work great. And he then said to me, we should meet in person. And we came up with a secret place where we could meet. It was Panera Bread. And we would meet there like once a week or twice a month, maybe on a weekend. We soon learned that if you meet at the height of lunch hour, it was much harder to get a table. But if you do it in the middle of an afternoon at like 3 p.m., the place was relatively empty. And we would just meet there, sit down. I'd take out my computer and he'd start telling stories and I'd type them in. And then I would obviously take that raw material and make it into the stories that the book told. And each time I'd share it with him and he'd have a chance to read, think of other stories or say, I don't think we want that in there. But he really didn't do that because I basically was true to the, I mean, I was, but I never also pushed the envelope and said like, ooh, what did you really think of that? Like, what's the story behind that? I let him tell his stories and then I wrote them down. So he didn't have a whole lot to say, like, let's take that out, because anything that was in there were things that he told me. And again, I didn't pry.
That's a skill in itself, to be able to take raw interview material. My day job, I'm an editor, and I see that with some of my reporters. Some of them can take in an interview or sit in a meeting, process it, boil it down to the parts that are interesting and kind of discard what's not so interesting. And others, that is a much harder thing to do. So it's not as easy. I know that it's not as easy as, you know, listening to a story and then being like, boom, there it is. You know, here's a book.
Correct. Right. There's a process, and writing is hard, right? Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that people who don't write don't truly understand. So I retired at the end of the 2022 school year after a wonderful, fantastic, you know, I was an educator for 30 some odd years. I was a principal for 25 years, and it was great. And I loved every minute, but I've always been very active. And people say to me, well, what are you going to do now? And when I say I'm an adjunct college professor, they go, oh yeah, neat. But if I tell people, well, I write, they sort of give me a quizzical look like, yeah, all right. So what does that mean? Like, what do you do? And they don't understand that the process of writing is work, and it's hard. The other day, I just started a new book. It's actually about a different set of Yankees. None of them who ever really played baseball, because these aren't baseball Yankees. These are the Yankees who fought at Gettysburg. Hmm. I'm writing a book about the Civil War. So nice. There were Yankees there, but they're not baseball Yankees. And I had these great ideas, and I was at my computer, and I'm typing the introduction, and the phone rings, and it's my mom and dad. I'm like, hey, yeah, how are you? And then after I hang up with them, I had all these ideas. If they hadn't interrupted me, the book would have been published already. It would have been a Pulitzer Prize winner and won every book award. But once they called, all those ideas were gone, and I haven't been able to get them back again.
Oh, I definitely know how that goes. Get interrupted and trying to get your head back into that same space is extremely challenging.
It's a process, like anything else. Anything that's worth doing well takes time and effort.
So the book is written from Roy White's perspective, as him telling the reader the story. How did you plan out and decide how you were going to present the book? Because that's another thing that I think can be really challenging. I've worked with a couple of clients who are doing memoir or narrative nonfiction type things. It's a little bit more complicated than when you start a fiction story. Like fiction, you still have to determine, you know, whose perspective and you're going to write it from and what tense and all of that. But it does seem like nonfiction, and in the realm of memoir and biography, it can be hard to determine how to present it and what portions to present, and just how to put it together in a seamless way that's easy to read. And this book was easy to read. It felt like I was just sitting there listening to Roy White talk, and it was very enjoyable.
Thank you. Well, his story follows basically the arc of his life. So I didn't do anything super creative there. There's an introduction that begins with he talks about his greatest baseball memory, sharing a whole bunch of baseball memories. I wrote that basically even before we even started, just going through his career. And he then said, oh, add this, add that, take out this. But I knew based upon previous interviews where that was going to go. Like his greatest memory was just being a Yankee. There wasn't a signature moment per se, even though there were lots of great moments that he was part of. But then the rest of it just really begins with his childhood and goes right up through until his retirement as a coach many, many, many years later, you know, decades and decades later, and also encompasses all the years in the minor leagues, getting to the major leagues, and then leaving, coming back home, and the things he did as a coach with the Yankees. Some other things, he did some acting, though that happened during his career, but all the other little things that happened in his life that defined who he was as a human being and who he was as a former baseball player.
I really enjoyed how the story was told. I think going with a chronological approach, it really built on itself. And I enjoyed the first quarter, that early part of his life, a lot. I just found that section of his life really interesting because it's not a look that you get very often. And one of the things that he touched on, but it wasn't like a huge theme, was some of the racial tension that was still very prevalent in society during that time, and him trying to navigate it coming from the area that he grew up in and then being really introduced into a different society that he wasn't used to. And it was interesting to see it through his eyes and kind of this awakening of like, oh,
right.
This,
so when he gets to the Yankees, he grows up in Compton, right? So he grows up mm-hmm. in Los Angeles, basically. And while he says that he had heard about segregation and racism and things like that, he had never really experienced any of that in his life. They just were people, right? And he signs with the Yankees and their spring training's in Florida in the still segregated South of the early 1960s. And for the first time in his life, he finds out that certain players can't stay in the hotel. He's an African-American, so he then couldn't stay with his team at minor league stadiums. He heard racial comments being hurled at him from fans. He saw that the fans, even in the minor league stadiums, were segregated into different areas based upon color. He found he couldn't even go into certain restaurants with his teammate. He told it later during a public appearance that we had together. But he tells the story a lot now. He was walking in a southern town and there was a restaurant and he looked in the window and there was a African-American woman who was working there. So he went in and sat down and grabbed a menu and nobody would serve him. And the woman finally came up to him and she said, "You can't eat here." And he goes, "But you can work here." And she goes, "Yes, but you can't eat here. You got to go around outside and they'll give you something out of the kitchen window, but you can't eat in this restaurant." He was outraged. But again, Roy White's dignity and class comes through. I think if you ask the majority, the vast majority of people, they would hold that anger forever. I might. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I never experienced. But these are the types of things like this absolute injustice. You'd say, like, "I'm never going to forgive people for that." But when you ask Roy White about it, he says, "Yeah, I had it tough. That wasn't easy. But, you know, the guys who came before me, they had it even rougher." And that's just something that you don't find. You know, you were talking about how we made the connection and how we started to meet. And obviously, we still talk. You know, he calls me every now and again, which is just amazing when my phone rings and Roy White's calling me. I say, "Hello, Mr. White." And he says, "You can call me Roy." I can't. But a lot of times you meet these heroes in your life and they turn out to be less than how you had always hoped. We're mm-hmm. all human. We all have clay feet. I have to say, Roy White was none of that. And he is none of that. He is the absolute dignified gentleman that everyone always says he was. And he is that way. I've been at autograph signings with him now and public events. And sometimes you see the athletes being gruff and like, "Here's my autograph, get out of here." Mm-hmm. He takes the time with every single person who comes up to him and he talks to them and he engages with them. And they're like, "Roy, could I ask you this question?" "Sure. What do you want to know?" And it's just amazing because he connects. No one, when we have these things, is coming up to me and being like, "You're Paul Semendinger. You wrote the book." They're like, "Yeah, who cares? You want my autograph too in the book?" "I guess, yeah. He signed it somewhere far away from Roy White." "I want to talk to Roy White." And he's so classy and he's so nice to everyone, which is really great to see.
That is good. That's the impression you get reading the book. The way he talks about other people, the way he doesn't self-aggrandize his own accomplishments. And it's very much, I think he spends more time talking about other people's accomplishments than his own. There's like a few things where it's like, "Yeah, I had that record." And "Yeah, it still stands." And exactly. It probably always will. Just did some impressive things in his career. And I found it really touching that so much of what he wanted to talk about was the experience and the friends he made and his love of baseball and the sport and just how much it meant to him to be a part of that world for as long as he was. And it was really neat to see over time his story and his perspective and that first day of like, "I'm at the stadium," like so excited to walk in there. And even when he's injured and it's like, "I'm in the Yankees area."
And I grew up wanting to be a Yankee. So I can't imagine what that was like. He lived the dream that so many of us wanted.
Yeah.
I've never been in a Yankees locker room. And if I were, they'd all look at me like, "What are you doing here?" Right? Like, they welcomed him. He tells the story of Mickey Mantle coming over and saying, "Hi, Roy, I'm Mickey Mantle." It's like, I don't think I need you to tell me who you are. You're Mickey Mantle.
Yeah, I know. He held on to that. Kind of assume he still feels that way of just that awe of the game and that sense of like, I got to do that. That's awesome. Like, it didn't seem to, you know, go to his head. I think that can really affect and change a person, especially coming from a place where he didn't have a lot. And suddenly you're the guy people want the autograph from and want to see coming out of the stadium. To maintain that sense of self and treat people around you with respect and be kind to the fans, even though, you know, sometimes fans can not be that great.
That is correct. I wouldn't mind if people would come up to me and go, "Hey, you're the guy who wrote that book, right? I love that book." Those moments don't necessarily come very often, if at all. But I think if you're a Major League Baseball player and day in and day out, people are cheering for you and asking for your autograph and putting you up on this pedestal, I think it's a natural human inclination too, to like to become thinking like, I'm better than everyone else. Mm-hmm. And it takes a special person, somebody like Roy White, who didn't and doesn't act that way. He still remains humble and understands that he's a person just like the fans. He just happened to be a Yankee and a really good one at that.
Yeah. Well, he seemed to carry that into the years coaching and working with younger, newer players and being that mentor and doing it in a way that really seemed to leave a mark on a lot of the players, that, you know, he was someone that really meant a lot to them. And it wasn't just, yeah, he's the guy that yells at me when I, you know, get things wrong. You know, that's a hard thing too, like to stay in that gentle mentorship of helping someone along through their career and teaching them and not getting frustrated. Those attitudes can creep in, and it really seemed he held on to that, and really his personality and his love of the game led the way that he played and how he coached and really just how he lived his life. And I thought that that was just really neat overall. I mean, even if you're not a fan of baseball, I think non-baseball people would really just enjoy reading about his life and the kind of person that he was. I think people can take a lot away from that.
Exactly. Right. Because it's a human story. He tells a human story. You know, people have said to me, "Oh, are you going to write another book about another player?" And I thought about that. And I put some feelers out and things like that. And maybe. But sometimes people say, like, "Oh, you're going to do a tell-all book? What about if you write?" And I say, I don't want to write a book like that. I don't want to be the guy who exposes the hidden truth behind. I'd rather just tell the story of, you know, the people and the good, the bad, or the indifferent, but tell this the right story. I'm not looking to sensationalize things. And, you know, Roy White and I both had the exact same agenda for the book, to tell Roy White's story and to not delve into the muck and the mire and all the other stuff.
I appreciate that. I really enjoyed reading it. And we are pretty much out of time, but I do want to remind everyone, the book is called Roy White, From Compton to the Bronx, and that's by Paul Semendinger. And so look it up. It's available pretty much everywhere.
Everywhere, yes. It's at Barnes & Noble, so that's one of the fun things, right? You go into a bookstore, and then you see your books on the shelf. We just went out to dinner a couple weeks ago. My whole family was home. I have three kids and their girlfriends and wives and fiancés and all that. And we went to the Cheesecake Factory, and I don't know about in New Mexico, but in New Jersey, if you go to the Cheesecake Factory, there's always a long wait. And there's a Barnes & Noble next door. So we were watching around the Barnes & Noble, and I'm like, "Hey, those are my books. They're on the shelf. Look, I'm famous." So it's pretty cool. So yeah, you can get it at Barnes & Noble. You get it on Amazon. You can get it at Artemisia Publishing.
And where can people find you and follow you to stay up to date on new projects that might be
on the way? Oh, that's great. Thank you. So my blog that is about me is just simply www.drpaulsem.com, drpaulsem.com. But I also have a Yankee site if you want to read about the Yankees. And right now, because the Yankees haven't been so good, you could read me and many of my writers complaining about the Yankees at startspreadingthenews.blog. It's all one word. And we put out multiple articles every single day. So it's an quite extensive, in-depth Yankee site.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I will check that out. Right.
Awesome. And thank you.
I just want to say thank you for taking the time. We had some difficulties connecting because I think, I don't know what's going on with my phone, but I appreciate your patience in making the
time.
No,
it's all good. Listen, technology is what it is. Things happen. We're all used to this.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully I'll figure it out at some point. But yeah, just, I appreciate it. I really enjoyed the book, and I hope you do get a chance to maybe interview some other players and just for fun, if nothing else, because that's awesome. And best of luck with your new project, and love to have you back when you're ready to talk about that one.
I can't wait. I'm happy to come back on anytime. Thank All you right. so much. You're a gracious host.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.